heckled by fajitas. That's what's coming up on The Art of Bombing, episode 222. What could beer, boats, and biology possibly have in common? Well, they're all themes of my new podcast. Hello, friends. I'm Dan Bublitz Jr., and I'm here to tell you about my new podcast, Submerged with Dan Bublitz Jr., a weekly interview-style podcast about obsessions. In each episode, I sit down with comedians, artists, and everyday people that submerge me into the things that they love. Sharing their passion for topics such as pop culture, hobbies, science, sports, and much, much more. Each week, I'm joined by a new guest to share a new obsession. In season one, I talked to my friend Eric Braley, a toy shop owner, about Transformers. In another episode, I talked to graphic designer Michelle Mildred about indie nail polish. And I even talked with comedian and writer Lisa Curry about boats and growing up at a family-owned marina. Submerged with Dan Bublitz Jr. starts November 3rd, 2021, and is available wherever you get your podcasts. Don't miss an episode and subscribe today.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, 'cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Welcome to a brand new episode of The Art of Bombing. I'm your host, Dan Bublitz Jr., and with me, as always, is my new co-host and producer, Josh Shirley. How's it going?
Good, man. I prefer to be introduced as Josh to the Shirley.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So maybe on the next one we can work on
it. One of these days I'll get it right. I'll get it right. It's Josh to the Shirley, and that's T-O-O. Just so we're clarifying, it's two,
and then
two, like too much, surely.
T-O-O and then T-H-A. The paperwork hasn't come back, so it's not official yet.
Okay, that's good to know. Well, once that's official, I'll make sure I correct myself when I do these intros.
Nice, man. Good to see you.
It is good to see you.
This is going to be fun.
Yes, this is going to be a great episode. We have a very great guest. This is a great way to end 2021, because this is our last episode of 2021. And on today's episode of Art of Bombing, we have Ryan Niemiller, which is a fantastic comedian who you may remember from America's Got Talent a few years ago. He was one of the finalists, did very well on the show. He's very funny. We had a great conversation with Ryan, and he talked a lot about the experience of America's Got Talent, and so it was very insightful on, you know, getting ready for, you know, getting your set ready and thinking about jokes and different things like that. So it's a very, very insightful conversation coming up today.
Yeah, get excited, guys. Ryan's a huge get. I was really happy when I heard that we landed him, and so this is absolutely going to be a blast.
Yeah.
Strap it.
Shout out to Lee Bruns, a big fan of the show, a good friend of mine as well. He's the one that actually put me on to Ryan as far as getting him as a guest. I knew who he was, but sure. Ryan put out a tweet about wanting to do podcasts, and my friend immediately tagged me in that. So I tweeted back. I was like, I would love this if it's serious. And then Ryan told me to slide into the DMs, as you do in the 21st century.
Oh, yeah, that is that's a pretty big moment in every relationship when you can move on to the DMs.
That's right.
Slid Facebook.
Right in there.
Yeah, it's like being invited into someone's virtual home.
It really is.
Congratulations.
But yeah, so it was great for us. So we were able to set it up and we were able to record, and we, like I said, it's a great conversation. But before we get to that conversation, take care of some business. I don't know, do you have anything coming up?
Nah, man, I am straight up going to be working on some jokes, going to be hitting some mics this week for sure, both virtual and in person. Mix it up like that's what I like to do. But no big gigs to announce on the show at the moment. Just trying to do the comedy as well as be a dad. And I'm a pretty terrible dad when I'm doing a lot of comedy because I can tell by how much broke stuff is laying around my house.
So what you're saying, there might be some correlation between the two.
Yeah, they correlate negatively, I would say, because the funnier I feel like I am and the more I'm crushing it on the road, the more my child's growing up alone and the more IKEA furniture there is to put together when I get back.
To replace the IKEA furniture that's getting broke while you're gone.
Yeah. He said he was going to come back.
Did you have a good holiday?
Yeah, I had a great holiday. Speaking of family, it was definitely a home run. Had a great time with my in-laws here in Kansas City. Got some quality time in with the wife, the kid, the dog, all the way around, man.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, we had a pretty decent holiday, too. It was pretty low-key, just me and my fiance and her mom, so pretty low-key. I went and visited my dad for a little bit, but he was working all weekend, so he was pretty busy. But, yeah, he's one of them people that had to work over the holidays.
Yeah, he came home. A lot of IKEA furniture to put together. A lot of... He had to spend some time with you. I totally get where he's at.
Exactly. But yeah, so it was a good holiday. And like you, I haven't really been doing a lot of comedy here in the last couple weeks because I'm getting ready for a lot of stuff happening next month with, moving to Denver and the movers are coming next week to get our stuff. And then we're going to be living in a hotel for about a month. We still haven't found a place to live. And then I'm a dummy and planned a bunch of comedy at the same time. I'm supposed to be moving, so be pretty busy. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to relax in December and the end of December and then the first part of January. I'm keeping it pretty low key. I do have one show though, and it's local. That's what's nice about this is I am doing a New Year's Eve show at New Hope Cinema Grill in New Hope, Minnesota, which is a suburb of the Twin Cities. So it's nice. I get to come home and sleep in my own bed after the fact, which is great. I don't have to stay in a hotel by myself. And it's great because it's a show that the headliners do every year. I think it's like their annual New Year's Eve party, but it's with two great comedians from the Twin Cities, Miss Shannon Paul and Tiffany Norton. They're really good friends. They do a lot of stuff together already, and they're both fantastic comedians too. So I'm excited because I just have to host, so it's pretty easy. Yeah. Go up, do a short set. Bring them up, let them, go to Crush Town, just stay out of the way, enjoy some comedy. It's kind of nice sometimes being the, getting that little break from having to, essentially when you're a headline, when you headline or feature, you got to kind of, especially as a headliner, you got to carry the show. I mean, hopefully.
Yeah,
if you're not,
I feel that.
If you're not carrying the show, well, then... I'm a guest still... on this podcast.
Exactly. There you go. Our forms are open, guys. Yeah, you're right. It's something I still kind of enjoy and probably take for granted, just being at the sort of more feature position in my career. I kind of get my stuff out of the way and I get to watch a nice long set with the headliner, as I've done with you on occasion. And I've just been able to kind of sit back and have a beer and enjoy the show. It's not something you get to do when you're working the whole time.
Yep. No, exactly. So that'll be good. Now, again, before we get into this great conversation, some other housekeeping we should take care of. Spotify just last week announced that you can now do 5-star, or you can do any rating, but we prefer 5-star. But you can now rate podcasts on Spotify, which that isn't something that they had prior. It's a new feature. So if you listen to our podcast on Spotify, we would really appreciate if you give us a 5-star rating, because then what that does is that helps other people discover the show. So you're helping us gain a wider reach, and that's ultimately good for us. The more people that listen to this, the better we can do that. The better, more people are going to get this great podcast, and we're going to be able to put more content out there. And we have some big plans for 2022.
That's totally right. And you don't just do it for us, guys. Do it for you. It's 2022 is going to be a big time here. Dan and I have some fun things in the works for you guys. That's going to be expanding the show to include a lot of fun things. And so that what makes that easier is more of an audience, all those types of things. And we're easier to find when you go and you give us 5-star ratings.
Yep, you can do it. Again, you can do that on Spotify. That's a new feature, but you can give ratings and reviews on most. You can do it on Apple Podcasts. You can do it on Good Pods, Podchaser. Maybe you can't do it on Good Pods. Don't quote me on that. But I know on Podchaser you can give ratings and reviews as well. Wherever you can do a rating and review, definitely do that. Make sure, if you're not already subscribed to the podcast or following the podcast wherever you listen to it, do those things as well. We're on all social media channels. We're on Twitch. We're on YouTube, and Facebook, where we primarily do our broadcasts when we do live streams. This one isn't a live stream, obviously. It wasn't a live stream, but when we do live streams, and we do have a really good one coming up, those are the platforms where you can watch it. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, at Art of Bombing, or you can go to the website, artofbombingpod.com. Do all that, at Art of Bombing Pod. Find us on all those places. And we got this is a great conversation. This is going to be a great podcast.
I'm ready, man. Let's get into it.
Okay, we got one more announcement before we get into it. One quick run.
Come on.
I know, I totally set you up to fail. I was like, I'm going to set him up, and then I'm going to take it away, because that's what I do. No, but before we get into this great conversation, I do want to remind everybody, we do have a live broadcast coming up Sunday, January 2nd, 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. That'll be on Twitch. It'll be on YouTube. It'll be on Facebook. We have a great guest. Dobie Maxwell is the guest. He's a legendary comedian. He's been in the business for over 30 years. He's seen and done it all. He has a great Facebook group that he curates, where it's one of the better, because he doesn't put up with negative BS, and he doesn't put up with tons of spamming and things like that. He keeps it clean. And he keeps it focused on helping comedians get better at comedy. You know, it's called the Maxwell Method of Comedy. So, you know, he's corporate comedy, just clean comedy, you name it, he's done it all. He's got a lot of experience. So if you're going to tune into an episode live where you can ask questions as we're doing the conversation, that's going to be a good episode to tune into.
Yeah, our show is all about how to get funnier, guys, whether you're a comedian, a speaker, anybody like that. And I would say that Dobie Maxwell is somebody that's got a ridiculous amount of experience to offer someone in that position. So get there, check it out on the 2nd.
Absolutely. All right. Now, let's get into this conversation with Ryan.
Can we please?
Yes, now we can.
And now, it's time for the stand-up soundbite.
She lived in California, and I was on the road all the time, so we were long distance. We never saw each other, and it was amazing. Long-distance relationships are the best. If anyone tells you otherwise, they're a dirty liar. Tell that to their face, because they're awesome. Long-distance relationships are so good, because like, how it worked for us, why I loved it so much. We went to see each other for like 3 months. And in that 3 months, if you don't see someone for that long that you want to see, that anticipation builds up. So you get real excited. And then like a weekend opens up, so you get like 3 days to see each other. And if you haven't seen, what? You say she's cheating on me? My hand's a fucking dildo. She ain't cheating on shit.
So you mentioned that this last weekend you recorded your special. How did that go? Where did you record at?
So we recorded at Zany's in Nashville, which is one of my favorite clubs in the entire country. We set it up where there was 5 specials that were recorded this weekend.
Oh, wow.
Three by the Well-Read Comedy guys. So Trey Crowder, Drew Morgan, and Corey Ryan Forrester. And then on Sunday, Brent Terhune and I each recorded our specials.
So cool.
They five this weekend. I was obviously it's hard to tell until everything gets edited and like mixed and all that. They felt good. The actual sets felt good. So I think we got something there, which is nice. It didn't feel like a waste of time and their money. So
right.
That's nice.
That's always a good thing. That's kind of how Dry Bar Comedy does theirs too. They really pump out, you know, they do three a night and they do Friday, Saturdays when they record. So they're doing six specials in a weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. It was nice too. I like for us, they did two shows. And they separated us because, like, the well-read guys have a little bit different fan base than Brent does, than a little different than I do. So that way, because that's the thing that can be sometimes a little tricky about, you know, the Dry Bar or when they do, like, the Comedy Central half hours. The audiences aren't always necessarily there for you specifically.
Yeah,
they're there because, oh, we're recording. There's Comedy Central specials tonight.
Yeah,
they don't necessarily know who you are ahead of time. They don't know who they're seeing. For this, since we got to advertise it as, hey, we are recording our specials. Who wants to come? We had people, like, there was people wearing our merch and stuff. So it kind of just made it like it felt a little less stressful because you knew, like, okay, at least they're here on purpose.
Yeah.
<They're> not just, you know, they like us at least enough to show up ahead of time, which is nice.
No, yeah, that's awesome. So I assume this is a video special then?
Yeah, so we did a video and audio. So we had it, we had it recorded. My buddy Ross, who runs On Tour Records out of Lexington, Kentucky, he recorded all the audio for it. They recorded the video for us to be able to shop in the spring, and then also hoping to get some of those tracks on Sirius.
Awesome.
So something will happen with this. We don't know what that means yet, but yep. Something's going to happen. Which
that's
is very
great. Cool. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
I just recorded an album. I did the video too, but I might release that on my YouTube. But I recorded an album in my basement. I did a basement show, and just this last August, which was a lot of fun. So I just got just this morning, I got the final edits back.
And oh, very cool.
All
very
mixed. Cool. So I'm still shopping it around before if I just, you know, I haven't decided if I'm going to just release it myself or, you know, I'm kind of shopping it around, but.
Yeah. I mean, the way that, and this is me not really knowing anything about how this business works. I've just gotten very lucky, and I associate with people smarter than me. the good thing is with how things work now, there's always options to self-produce.
Yep.
Like, obviously, it's always nice if, like, oh, Comedy Central bought this, Netflix bought that. You know, like, it's like that's like the dream.
Yep.
But if they don't, you still have ways to get that stuff on Sirius, for instance. You can still get it on Apple. You know, you can get it on iTunes. You can get it on there's ways you can do it without needing the big corporate monster behind you to push it. So that takes at least a little stress off.
Yep.
So no's don't feel as bad as they used to.
Oh, that's for sure.
Because you can be like, I'll just do it my damn self. I don't care.
Yeah, you're spot on that. And a lot of comics did that, especially during the pandemic. You know, there's a lot of great comics that released their own specials on YouTube, and they did very well. Maybe not financially, but it definitely helped them, you know, get a lot of followers and things like that and build a fan base. So when they're touring, people are coming
to see
them.
And a lot of times it's a slow burn like that, you know, like you can get some major company to buy it, but like, and then if they don't produce it, sure, you might have got like some cash up front, but if they didn't really get behind you, they didn't really push it, they didn't really advertise it, they didn't announce when it was going to be out, whatever. You do it yourself and you do all that legwork and you can get, you know, 3-4 million views on YouTube or something like that. Those people might actually like you and then now buy tickets and, you know, you'll make your money long term. You might not get that check right off the bat.
Yep.
But you get people who will then come see you over and over again. And that's really where you make your money until you're like getting those huge money contracts.
Yeah. Until you're doing theaters.
Four of us. Yeah.
being able to do theaters, getting those big TV deals, things like that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the dreams that we're all
exactly, which is reserved for about five comedians total.
Exactly, you gotta wait for some of them to exit.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then there's a ton of competition, and then, you know, the other thing with that too, like shopping it around. Even if a company buys it, they might not release it. So you're getting that money, but it still doesn't get produced.
Yeah, you know, you did nothing with it. You know, they just changed their mind. There's someone, whoever was behind you when they bought it, now has moved to a different job or got fired or whatever else. And the new guy doesn't care about you at all. And there's so much I've learned just over 15 plus years of doing this that nothing, I don't announce anything too strongly or assume anything's going to happen until I'm actually in the middle of seeing it or doing it.
Sometimes,
you know, like even when I got America's Got Talent, like they tell you months in advance.
Yeah,
and they're always very careful to let you know, okay, there's like a 90% chance we're going to have you come in and audition in front of the judges. So you don't want to start going like, hey guys, guess what I'm doing? Because the second you do that, the comedy gods come in and they take that from you. So
yep.
I didn't believe it was going to happen until I was literally standing in front of like Simon Cowell and Howie Mandel. And I was like, okay, this is real now. I'm actually
got to put my game face on now.
I should actually try now. Yeah, there we go. I should have prepared something.
Yeah. And that's an interesting, obviously that's a great catapult for comedians, especially, you know, if you make it into the finals and everything, and you did very well on the show. How did that come about for you?
It took a long time. It was a very long process for me. So I tried in various ways to get on that show, I think five separate times. It was four or five separate times. Going all the way from just showing up at one of the sites and, you know, going to the cattle call and waiting around forever and going up there to, you know, they're like, you know, there's things they give you called, I can't remember exactly what they call them, but it's basically like, you're invited to audition.
Yep.
So it doesn't mean anything. The only thing that's different than just showing up and waiting in line is you get to set like a time slot.
Yep.
That's literally it. It means nothing else. It doesn't mean you're guaranteed. It's just like, we maybe want to take, we remember you from last year. We want to take a little closer look at you. Come in at 2 p.m. instead of just having to wait around for 8 hours. So I did that a couple times. And then what actually got me the yes to go actually on the show, in between the last two times that I tried, I had an old stand-up clip randomly go viral. So I'd filmed my only TV, real TV credit before that, I'd filmed for a little spot for Laughs on
yep.
Fox, which was Steve Hofstetter's show.
Yep.
Steve's one of my best friends in comedy. I've known him for years. So I did that, filmed that for him. He had like the full footage for that. And then when he bought Comedy Juice and started putting viral videos out, essentially, he asked me, he's like, hey, we have this footage, you care if we use it? And I was like, I don't have to do anything. He's like, nope. All right, cool, go ahead.
That's awesome.
And it caught on. Like, it didn't go, it's not the most viral thing that ever happened, but it got like, you know, 1.7 million views, which is, you know, most I'd ever had.
That's huge. That's still huge.
Yeah, so I was pumped about it. And then the next year, when the next season of AGT was rolling around, I reached back out to them and I was like, hey, so I have this video now, like this happened, you know, and then because like since that video was from a TV taping, they got to see what I looked like on TV, because that's the hard thing when you're doing comedy. If you're just doing a normal show, like we're kind of just taught and you learn as a comic, you do what the audience gives you,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's like you don't go into a dive bar with three drunks and pretend it's Carnegie Hall or Madison Square Garden because the energy won't match, you know, it'll be very incongruent. What they want, though, so like when you go in and audition for them in person, the room might have at most four people in it. It's going to have a producer or like a, you know, a talent person, a camera person, and sometimes they bring you in with like maybe one or two other acts.
Yeah,
you know, so they can go boom, boom, boom. That's not normal stand-up comedy energy. So your instinct is as a comic is to, oh, let's play up how empty this room is. Let's, you know, let's do that energy. They don't want that. They want to know what you're going to look like on television. So you have to, like, basically pretend that it's, you know, there's eight cameras and it's packed and there's all these lights. And that's kind of what I learned after that video got, like, a pretty much immediate yes. I went, oh, I should have done that before.
Now, that's a really good observation, too, because when you go to the auditions, because I myself, I know exactly what you're talking about with those auditions because I did them all, too. I did the cattle call. I did the where you got to do your appointment. Same scenario where you go in with a few other acts and do it in front of a couple producers, and that's something I never even thought about, is that you should go in thinking about, oh, this is, they're looking to see what you're going to look like on TV, so maybe you should be dressed for how you're going to be on TV, and you should be doing your act like you're on TV. That's an amazing observation.
Yeah, and it's something that you don't know until you know.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
It's one of those things. Because the thing I had to get into my head, and even when I was doing the show itself, it's not a stand-up comedy show. It is a talent/personality show. Like they're very respectful of your art. You know, if it's important to you, they're going to treat it as important. But, like, their primary goal is to put on a very good television show. They don't care about the intricacies of stand-up comedy. They don't care about – no. You're there to help them put on a good TV show. So you have to kind of swallow your pride a little bit and be like, okay, artistically, this might not be what I would do under normal circumstances, but I got to play the game a little bit because this is a much bigger production than just, oh, let's showcase what stand-up comics can do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's very true. That's a good point there, too. Because you're right. That's what, I mean, at the end of the day, they're after ratings, you know, and being able to sell advertising and putting on a good show. All those things are what's important to them.
Yeah, they treated me super well. I love everyone I met there. I would never speak ill of them. I don't want to make it sound like I'm being snarky because, like, they treated me great. I was treated very, very well the whole time. They liked me. I liked them. But at the end of the day, you have to realize as the talent, you're a cog in a much bigger machine.
Absolutely. You know? No, that's a very good observation. Very good point. Because they
can find any jackass to do comedy for 90 seconds.
Yep.
You know?
I
don't want to downplay what we do whatsoever. I don't want to imply comedy's hard. But if all they wanted was somebody who could tell jokes and be funny for 90 seconds, there's thousands of us.
Oh, absolutely.
There's so much more that goes into it than
we're
just
everywhere.
Exactly. We ain't that special. None of us.
No, not at all. Oh, that's great. Well, that's awesome that ended up working out, because that definitely, you know, that has to feel good as a comedian to have something that kind of helps launch a career, because, like you said, you know, from some people's perspective, they see you on that show and they're thinking, oh, wow, this is a overnight success. He came out of nowhere. And it's like, no, he was doing comedy for like 15 years prior, you know. A lot of regular people don't realize that these, you know, especially like even Fresh Faces or any of that stuff. A lot of these times, these comics are comics that have been in the business for so long.
It was always the funniest thing. And I never, it's not like I got into these deep conversations with people about it, but that was always the funniest thing that happened to me. Like, so I got third place on the show, which is amazing. There is nothing, I'm very proud of that. Obviously, I would have liked to win. But I'm not, there is no sadness involved with getting third. It's made me a national headliner now.
Yep.
I get to pay my bills doing this. I'm in really good shape now. I'm very happy with that. But people who just watch that show casually don't always make that connection. So the amount of messages and like DMs, it was very nice, but they're like, hey, sorry you didn't win, but please don't quit. You should really keep, you know, just keep at it, man. Like, just because you didn't win doesn't mean you still can't do something. You know, just don't quit. And I was like, okay, I'll power through. Thank you for, I was going to quit, but you really encouraged me to go through. Meanwhile, I've like in the first like month, I made more than I made in 15 years prior of comedy, just because it's such a quick thing. Like, but again, like it speaks to your point though. A lot of people who just watch that show, they don't understand. Not just for the comics, but for almost everybody outside of, like, you know, the 10-year-olds, because they haven't been alive.
Yeah, they haven't been alive long enough. Yeah,
they haven't existed. But like a lot of people on that show have been doing what they do and honing that craft for a long time.
Yep.
And this is finally like, it's like, oh, now finally people get to see it. I get my chance to show what I've been working on for decades.
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's amazing. Because I've known other comics too that have done really well on that. It's definitely a good career launcher. I myself, I don't have anything against them either, except for the fact that they haven't put me on the show yet. Every time I audition, I get passed, but no.
Yeah. I hate them until they want me. Then I love them.
Exactly. So if you're, if any producers are from AGT are listening, I'll stop hating as soon as you put me on. No.
The second you give me a, I will sell out in a heartbeat.
That's, you're damn right. You're damn right. Now,
it was amazing, like talking to some, like, and not anyone successful per se, but some of the comics. It's weird how people will view certain shows like that. Like for me, going on AGT and being seen by 10 to 15 million people every week, and now people know who I am and recognize me at airports and stuff like that. That was so worth it. But like, they'd always be like, hey, when you go on that show, you're going to do the show, okay, cool, but don't use your A material, because then they own it. And it's like, what bigger thing than this would I be saving this material for? Like getting to, yeah, getting to work Des Moines, Iowa. And like, I love Des Moines, but like, what am I saving this? Like, what's a bigger opportunity to like save this, my greatest material for, than getting seen by 15 million people?
And right, like I'm being seen worldwide. I should probably do my best material.
Yeah, yeah. What's the biggest showcase? And it's one of those things. It's like, I'll gladly give up. Like, I did 7 sets between AGT and Champions. Mm-hmm. I did like 7 about 2-minute sets. I think all told, it was maybe 17 or 18 minutes of comedy. Guess what? I'll write another 18 minutes of comedy for that type of exposure and the work I get to do now. Like, are you kidding me? Why would I hold on to my good stuff?
No, so for
you're gonna
sure.
You're going to get my scraps, AGT. It's like, you gotta go into this knowing what it is, you know? Like, that's why you work hard.
Yep.
Is so that people will see you. You want to put out your, you know, your best stuff. You want to put your best foot forward. Because you go out there once and you kind of hold back a little. Oh, I don't want to get my good stuff. Then you're eliminated and you're done. It doesn't matter.
Yep.
No one cares.
Yep. And I feel like that's a mistake a lot of comics make on that show too. They like hold back and then they get, you know, don't make it any further. And it's like, what, you're right. What are you saving it for? If you, the longer you're on the show, whether you win or not, but the longer you make it, the more people see you, the bigger you're going to be when it's all said and done, whether you win or not, because you're there, you're getting that much more airtime.
Exactly. Every week that I was on the show, so like every round I passed through, so like going into the audition, I was like, okay, here's the best set I think that'll kind of, because they don't know you yet, so you kind of want to like do introductory stuff. Like, I was like, this will work great, and that went well, and I was like, okay, hell, what do I do now? So I come up with the best set I could think of in my head, and then I move on to the judge cuts, and you kind of go, well, shit, now what's my best set? And you go up the best stuff you can think of right there, and then I moved on from the quarterfinals, and I'm like, damn it. Okay, now I need another good set. What's the, like, so it's like you just go in and you enjoy it for about 15 seconds because you're like, oh, thank God I moved on. Oh, no. Now what do I do? You're scrambling to find the best stuff you can do for that. Because like you said, it doesn't matter. If you have bullets in the chamber, but you're already thrown out, who cares?
Yep.
Nobody's going to see it. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing I wouldn't mind talking about a little bit too, is like the process of constructing a set. You know, what kind of, like, obviously you're going into it with I got to do my best jokes. You advance and then the same thing, but kind of what did you kind of decide? How did you kind of do each round and decide what kind of material you were going to do, put your set together?
So it changed as you go further along, because I don't know how I think they changed the format a little bit now just because of COVID and everything with kind of how it works now. But for my season, how it worked was I found out about November of 2018 that I was probably getting to audition in person. The actual audition was in March of 2019. So I had 4 months, and you kind of you get like your own individual producer, basically, who kind of helps you. You know, they kind of here's what they're looking for. Here's what we need to do. You send videos of you trying those jokes. They give you notes and you tweak and you do that. So you get like 4 months. For me, essentially, what they wanted me to do, and it was a good call. They wanted jokes from the clip that I auditioned with, essentially. Because I was like, oh, maybe I'll try this. I want to do something different. They've already seen that. And they're like, nope, do what was in there. So the first one was actually pretty easy to prepare, because I just had to trim down like 4.5 to 2.5, basically. That's all I had to do. Relatively easy in the grand scheme of things. After that, you then have to start like racking your brain, because for comedy, it's especially hard. If you're a singer, and I can't sing, so I don't want to downplay the talent of it, you can just cover somebody's song on there. You're just like, oh, I can sing Elton John, and then you just do Elton John's song, and then you move on or not. I can't cover Jim Gaffigan. You know, I can't just go do his bit.
Not if you want to keep doing comedy.
Exactly. So what you have to do, and what makes it tricky, especially because like I'm not like a one-liner comic, I had to be able to find, you know, at most maybe 2.5 minutes. That's about as far as you get to stretch, give or take. 2.5 minutes, you got to find bits that all kind of fit together, at least loosely, are clean enough for television. Like, that's the no-brainer. That's like, so many people would always ask me, was it hard not to be dirty? No, it's NBC. Of course you can't say the F word. Like, duh. Like, that's not, you don't even consider those filthy jokes. But like finding stuff, and then you have to maneuver around, because like what you might think is clean might not be what NBC doing primetime television thinks is clean. So you kind of have to maneuver around that a little bit. And what's really scary about doing comedy on a show like that is if you only get 2 minutes, if one joke misses, you're done. It is so hard to recover because like you don't have enough time to fix it. If you're doing an hour, this joke early sucked. I'm going to have 50 more minutes to fix this and get them on my side and try and play and do things. With that, if those jokes don't work, you're screwed. You're done. And you have to be really punch heavy. So you have to factor in things like that too. You can't set up a 2-minute bit that has one good punchline at the end.
Yeah.
They want, you know, 10 seconds laugh, 10 seconds laugh, 5 seconds laugh. So you have to really find stuff like that. So that process, it was stressful. Because that's not what my normal act is. My normal act is I do an hour, I'm going to tell stories, I kind of lean into it a little bit, I'll go fast, I'll go slower, depending on... For this, it's like, nope, hit them hard, hit them fast. That's why half my sets ended with me just yelling. So I was like being loud and yelling will get you a laugh every time. So every set I tried to end with just getting louder for some reason. And like that worked. So.
Yeah, but hey, whatever works. It got you there, And, you know, to this show's credit, it, like I said, it definitely is a great avenue for entertainers to get seen and be able to, you know, hopefully have a long-lasting career. I know the season that Vicky Barbalak was on there, you know, she's a San Diego comic. And, you know, I had met her a few times. I didn't know her that well when I lived in San Diego, but you knew who she was and I met her a few times. But she'd been doing comedy for like 20-some years and then got on that show, did really well on the show, and now she's like headlining across the country, you know, just across the world. It's like, even after...
Same deal with me. You know, it's like, I was working, but like, it was kind of like, the comedian version of paycheck to paycheck is basically what I was doing. You know, I could technically pay my bills, but I was one, you know, flat tire and missing a gig away from having to call my brother to borrow money for rent.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of what I was before. And now it's like I get to travel around. I'm headlining these clubs that I always dreamed to be on. You know, people recognize you in public. It's a really cool thing. And it's fast. Like that show is one of the last comedy credits that's like immediate. It used to be like Tonight Show. You know, you get on the Tonight Show, you do well, Johnny invites you to sit down, you're made for a while. I want to do the Tonight Show for me. It just doesn't have that same clout anymore. You can have a great set on the Tonight Show, and it's cool, and it kind of adds, it stacks on to what you're doing, but you don't sell out a club, you know, on a Thursday after you had a great set on a Wednesday on the Tonight Show. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
Nope, not anymore.
So AGT will do that, though.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's great. Well, this has been great talking about all this fun stuff and like the highlights of your career, but we can't do this podcast without talking about.
Sorry, having a bad connection. I got to go. See you later.
I'm out.
I want to talk about how great I am and the greatest moment of my life, and now I'm gone. Thank you.
You're welcome. But yeah, so we got to talk about, because obviously you got to have bad sets to get to the good ones.
Yeah.
And that's what I'd love talking about on this podcast, because you can learn so much from those bad sets. So I'd love to hear about a show where you felt like you were, you know, it was either a really bad show or you were, you know, bombing really hard for whatever reasons.
So I have a couple that I can tell about that. So I don't say this to be cocky at all. I've been relatively lucky over 15 years that I haven't had a lot of colossal bombs. Now obviously I've had shows where I've done poorly, but I haven't had a lot of like stuff I would put in the memoir.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more just like, man, they did not like me tonight. That sucked. I've had a lot of that. But a couple of times, and I've had a couple of shows where I wasn't necessarily at my best, but also it was kind of the audience's fault too for things outside of my control. But I don't use that as an excuse. That is something I learned early, and I always, so for me, I always use the mantra that it's never the audience's fault, even when it's the audience's fault.
Yep.
Because there's always something in theory you can do to win an audience over. You might not have the skill set or the experience or, you know, whatever it is.
And I often find that's what it is. You don't have the skill set yet or the experience.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite example of that kind of proves that is the really famous the Bill Burr set that he did in Philadelphia. Where, like, there's drunk animals who have been destroying everywhere. And he just spent 15 minutes going, fuck you, motherfucker. You know?
Yep.
And by the end of it, they loved him, you know? So yep. It's like, I do not have that skill set. I would have not been able to win that crowd over.
Oh, me either.
You know, that would not have been me. So
they
would have bombed.
Destroyed me.
I would have bombed, yeah. But it does show that even the most volatile crowd, in theory, there's something you can do. So I never want to blame the crowd. But I have had a couple where I was not going to win on these particular nights. So I'll tell the shorter one first. This is the time that I was heckled by fajitas. So I'm doing, this is probably a year before AGT. So I was the middle. I was featuring for this set. I was with my buddy Mike Merrifield, who's a good friend of mine. He works for 800 Pound Gorillas now. Very funny comic. He's a good dude.
Oh, yeah. I've met him. I actually opened for him. Well, it would have been before the pandemic. Right before the pandemic, I opened for him.
Yeah, yeah. Mike's a good dude. Big fan of Mike. I always thought he's very funny. We've got along for years. So I'm opening for him in Kansas City. This is January. So to kind of set the stage of how things were already stacked against us, there is a huge blizzard. The show should have been canceled just for, like, bad weather, because a lot of people were like, we ain't coming out.
Yep.
No matter who's there, this is dangerous. So because of the weather itself, maybe 9-10 people there, you know, just for that. And then the other factor we had going against us is we were competing right after a Kansas City Chiefs playoff game.
So, oh man,
that they lost, I believe. So either people were now too pissed to show up, or if they did show up, they're mad because the Chiefs lost. So already the stage is not set well for us to do well anyway. I'm doing my set. Of course, this was a club where they did not seat people. So the 10 people who are there are all spread out as far as they possibly can be from each other. So there's no chance you could even build that kind of momentum amongst the small group. I'm powering through my sets. I never phone it in, even when I probably should. So I'm trying. I it's not the best set I've ever done, but I'm kind of grasping at straws, trying to figure out what to do here. They're not liking me, which is fine. I'm never mad if a crowd doesn't think I'm funny. They're wrong, but that's their opinion. That's fine. I'm in the middle of a setup. I'm trying to get something to work. I'm pulling stuff out of the archives I hadn't done for years. I was like, maybe I'll do something really dirty. I'm trying to figure out anything. I get in the middle of a setup, and all I hear from the back of the room suddenly is, it was so quiet in the room that somebody's fajitas that they ordered drowned me out where I couldn't even do my bit without acknowledging it. And again, not mad at the audience. If they weren't liking me, that's their right. They don't have to like me. I was more mad at the club, because what club serves fajitas, Dan?
Right?
That's the loudest food you could possibly serve at a comedy club? Like, did they run out of the steak that yells every time you cut into it? Like,
yeah, right.
Like the whole, like after that happened, like honestly, after the fajita thing happened, the rest of the set went okay because I just basically I stopped doing bits.
Yeah, just pretty much was like, yeah, I'm done.
Like, I was like, we all hate this, right? And I was like, yeah, and then we can kind of just talk as humans, and it was fine. But like that's the first time, and hopefully last time, I've ever been heckled by the food directly.
That's like that's almost worse than, you know, having, you know, comedy clubs that'll have the bar in the back and they'll do like shake drinks or blended drinks or whatever. It's thing. Like, what? What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, oh, gosh.
Heckled by the environment.
Yep, you just go, all right. I mean, because sometimes you'll get that with just bad locations. You know, like I've been heckled accidentally by, three ambulances drove by outside. And it's because you're right against the street. And you can't do anything about that. That's just bad luck. It happens, whatever. Yep. I feel they could control what foods are served in the middle of the show.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. But... The worst bomb I think I've ever had, and this was like almost a quit comedy bomb. Because like, I think we've all been there. Like, no matter how much you love doing this, and I love stand-up, if you don't want to quit at least a little bit every few months or so, you're not really passionate. Because it means you don't care.
Yeah.
It means you don't care enough about it if it doesn't make you want to just quit and go become an accountant.
I 100% agree with you.
Yeah, you got to hate what you love at least a little bit sometimes. So I, at this point, I'm probably, I don't know, 5-6 years into comedy. I'm at that point in your career where you start to get cocky and think that you're like really you'll never bomb again. Like you're really killing it. Because like at that point, I was starting to become a pretty good middle. Like I was a strong middle that like, oh, sometimes headliners have a little trouble following me. So you start getting this like little swagger, like, oh, yep, I'm untouchable.
A little bit of ego.
Nothing's ever going to stop me. And then I was starting to headline like kind of like bar one-nighters essentially. So I was like, it was my first kind of real taste doing consistent, you know, 45, 50 minutes, very low stakes in the grand scheme of things kind of gigs. But hey, feeling myself. I'm a headliner now, baby. Can't stop me. I'm doing this show. It's in Covington, Kentucky, so right across the river from Cincinnati, at a bar. I think it was called the Beer Cellar. I don't even think it's there anymore. It was booked by – I won't even use his full name because I don't – and it's not because I'm, like, worried about burying him. He's such a scumbag that I don't want him to get any kind of promotion from me. There is a he's a notorious douchebag booker out of Indiana – who basically everyone he's ever worked for, he has screwed out of money at some point. He didn't screw me out of money until much later, so that's not the point of this story, but he's a douche. That's what I'm saying. So he books the show. It's me and him on the lineup. He's going to kind of MC, and I'm going to like headline. I think there might have been one other guy doing a guest set or something. I don't remember. But he's the type of guy, and I'm sure you've encountered these people too, in your shorter career, but you've done this enough to see this, where – if somebody like hosts his own show or hosts their own show, if the crowd is terrible and there's nobody there, they'll go do like 3 minutes and maybe not even do any jokes, just bring you up as cold as possible because they don't want to suffer through it.
Yep.
But if it's a hot crowd, oh, now they're doing a 45-minute opening set.
Suddenly they're headlining at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. And they burn the crowd out and all that. So we get here. Four people show up for the comedy show, and they were all four personal friends of mine. So that was already a little humbling to begin with. The only people who came to the show, four people I went to college with. So that was already giving me go, oh boy, this is that's a weird energy to start with. The host guy, the booker, he goes up there, and because there's only four people, he's not going to do bits. He's not going to do jokes. So all he did was essentially insult my friends. So it was two guys I went to college with and their wives, but I knew them from there. So one of my friends is my buddy Jamal, who is a black gentleman. So he just told racist jokes at him, essentially.
Oh.
And then my other buddy, Brandon, basically just did jokes talking about how much he wanted to fuck his wife. So a good energy in the room already. Like, and he wasn't even doing jokes. He was basically just saying, like, I want to bang your wife. Like, that was the kind of stuff he was doing. So the stage is already just, like, there's no good energy. My friends are pissed now, but they're good friends. So they're going to at least give me a chance. I go up there. Now, obviously, my confidence is shot now because I think, oh, I wish a lot of people would have come to see me headline.
Yeah.
Nobody did before, friends. They're pissed, so there's already a weird energy. At that time, a lot of the bits I was doing was like, I didn't talk about my disability at all up front, and I would kind of like, oh, I'm doing these little other jokes and doing this, and then I would kind of do like a big reveal, and it's like, oh, the tension's been let out. Oh, good. My friends already know who I am, so that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I'm already scrambling to come up with jokes. They're politely laughing, but I'm bombing because I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle this unexpected turn of events that I did not prepare for when I arrived. So this in of itself is not a colossal bomb. There's nothing that feels rough about it. It's an unfortunate, uncomfortable night. You move on. Problem is, I'm maybe 20 minutes into my 45-minute set I'm supposed to do. The bar, there's a ferry outside for the river that goes across the river and will take fans to the Cincinnati Reds games. So essentially, it's just like if you're on the Kentucky side, you can park over here, take the ferry over, go to the game, you know, do whatever, drink, take the ferry back, whatever. The Reds are getting destroyed by the Chicago Cubs. It's like 16-4 or something like that. So the Reds are just getting throttled. So it's maybe the seventh inning of the game because, of course, they also left the TVs on in this bar.
Of course.
we can't turn those off.
Not in a bar.
So I know the Cubs are killing them. And I'm a Cubs fan, as you can tell by the shirt.
Yeah.
So like, I'm at least slightly happy at that. But halfway through my set, I see this big wave of white and red come into the door in front of the stage, and it's the incredibly drunk and angry Reds fans.
Oh, no.
Left early because they were getting throttled, so they're pissed, and now they're just here to drink. They don't care there's a comedy show going on, and there wasn't enough other people. There was only four people, my friends, in the audience, so there wasn't, like, enough people there to maybe make them be, like, aware that, like, oh, we're ruining something. So let's try to be, like, you know, let's go to the back or whatever. Since there was only four people, they just think there's some asshole talking on a microphone. So they're just being loud. I'm in the middle of trying to do jokes. They're like, shut the hell up! They're, like, yelling at me. Because, like, and again, I don't know how to handle this yet at this point in my career. I've not had to deal with this type of energy before. I'm pretty sure Marshawn Lynch stole this from me because I started doing, like, I'm like 20, 25 minutes in now. The last probably 15 minutes of my set was just, how much longer do I have to talk to make sure I get paid? It was just varieties of that. And then, like, some guy, like, yelled, like, you suck. Like, here's the problem. I have a problem, and I've worked on it since. But anytime I get heckled, and this is the reason I don't do online gaming. You can tell I'm probably a video game fan.
Yep.
I don't online game with strangers because if we're buddies and we're gaming together and you talk a little shit, that's fun. If you're a 13-year-old kid who threatens to bang my mother, I immediately go 0 to 100. It is instant for me. Like, and that's a fault of mine. I understand. I am not saying I am right to do this, but I'm the type of guy who, like, okay, you kill me in Call of Duty, and you're like, you suck. Well, I'm like, well, I hope you get cancer and die. Like, that's immediately where I jump. It does not make me a good person. You know, that's just who I am. That's way disproportionate to what just happened. That's how I used to deal with hecklers. I'd be the same way. Someone would talk a little bit. I like one guy, like, in the audience, he's like, why don't you tell a joke? I'm like, I hope you never stop killing yourself. Like, that's what I'm, like, yelling. So that just made them more mad.
Yeah.
Over there. It's the only time. So I power through the last 20. I will give myself credit. I didn't bail. You get hired to do a certain amount of time. You do your time.
Yep.
No matter how, and unless there's an actual physical risk to your safety or like a medical emergency or something, if you're getting paid to do 45, you do 45, even if you suck for 45. You make that happen.
Yep.
The second I kept doing like, how much longer do I got to do to get paid? Like 3 minutes. Watching the clock. Okay, how much longer? 1 minute. Did my minute. Set the microphone on the stool. Walked out. I didn't even bother. I just got my payment, left. Didn't say bye to my friends. I just got in my car and was gone. It took me a few weeks to kind of get that out of my system. But it's one of those things that I did learn something important from it, that because it ruined a couple shows after that, because it was just still in my head that this could happen. And I learned at this point that no matter what happens at the venue, you have to leave it there. Either way. So like if you bomb, if the show goes terrible, the second you get in your car, you have to let it go. And the same way where if you crush, you could kill it and get a standing ovation. You got to let that go when you get in your car too, because that next show might be the biggest bomb you've ever had in your life.
Yep. So and it's going to hurt audience, even worse when you're carrying that ego.
Exactly. Now, I'm not saying like you can enjoy it. I'm not going to like sit here and lie to you and say like it doesn't affect me. Nothing makes me feel happier than when I get a standing ovation. Like that is such a great ego boost. And yeah, soak that moment in. Enjoy it when you're there. Talk to the fans afterwards, sell your merch, just really soak that in. But the second you get in your car, you got to realize, okay, I'm back to level again, because I could eat the biggest dick ever at the next show.
Yeah.
So you got to keep in your head. And that's what I learned from this. Cause like that show, I never want to relive that feeling again, but I also don't want to relive letting something like that then ruin my next couple weeks of work too. Cause it's not the new audience's fault. They don't know what happened to you. You still got to bring it. You still got to do what you do.
You're absolutely right. Do you find it a little awkward performing for people, you know, like especially in that situation where the audience was just people that already knew you? So it's like, I don't know. I find it sometimes it's a little more difficult to, because when you're a comedian and you're doing jokes and you're doing your material, you're being a comic, you're doing your thing. And when you're with people, you know, whether it may not even be good friends, but even like people, you co-workers or whatever it could be. It's like, I always feel a little restricted. Like, I feel like I can't go all the way as a comic when people I know are there.
100%. And I always push through. Can I always try to tell people like, hey, I'm going to do what I do, you know, cause sometimes people were like, oh, I'm going to bring my mom. Well, your mom's going to learn that I like to say fuck a lot, you know, that's gotta be part of it. And, I do though. It's true. It's one of those things. I've gotten better now. Cause like, I love my friends and family enough that like, if my chance to see them is them coming to a show, I 100% want them to come to a show.
Cause
I want to
see them. Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And I also feel like I'm established enough in my career now where they know that like, oh, I'm not going to give them a personal shout out when, you know, on AGT's stage.
Yeah.
you know, like, I'm not going to take that time.
Take like two jokes and then the rest is just shouting out family.
Yeah, what up, everybody? You know, like they know that I'm a professional. Like, this is what I do for a living, but I'm not going to make it about them in our moment. But for me, I even hated it early, and it might be a little different for what some other people might. Comedy is one of like those art forms and skills that the only way you know if you're good at it is if you can make people who don't give a shit about you laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I am my mom's favorite comic, and that feels great. I love my mom to death. I love that she loves what I do. As far as her thinking I'm funny, I don't care, because she's my mom. Of course she does.
Yep.
My mom loves me. You know, I need people who don't care if I live or die on the way home to think that I can be funny. You know, if they think I'm funny, those are people who are going to buy tickets. They're going to buy merch. They're going to support me. That's how you know you're actually good. Simon Cowell, and he doesn't know much about comedy at all. That's just, he's kind of notoriously, he doesn't get how stand-up works.
Yeah.
He actually had a really poignant comment that they cut from the final airing when I did my audition. He was like, you can't fake laughter, you know, because like if someone's up there singing a song, you can politely laugh and smile or clap and smile at it and be fine. You can't fake laughter. You either laugh or you don't.
Yep.
You know, like that's a genuine feeling. And that's kind of how I always feel with that. Like you need to make actual people laugh. And my friends love me. My family loves me. It's cool that they're there, but of course they're going to laugh. I don't know if my joke's good.
Yeah. Yep.
I just know they still like me.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what I get out of it. So I always want to be strangers, or if my family or friends show up, I don't want to know where they're sitting.
Yeah.
I don't want to know where they're at.
Yep.
You know, because for the special, you know, I had some people who knew me, you know, my sub friends and some people come to the show, which was awesome. I didn't want to know where they were because I didn't want to like start like accidentally focusing, like checking in like, oh, do they think I'm funny still? Do they think that was good? I just want to be able to do my thing.
Yeah.
So I'm totally with you on that.
Yeah. Well, and the reason I ask about it, you know, with your story, It you know, kind of reminded me of this. So I just got booked. I got booked to do, I'm doing a holiday party in January. Okay. And I got booked through an event planner. I've performed at this particular venue where this holiday party is going to be. But I've performed there before. But the holiday party is for a company that I worked at 10 years ago that I actually quit that company to pursue stand-up comedy. So comedy's going like full circle, but I know there's going to be a lot of people that I worked with there. So I'm still like, while I know I can do it, I'm fine because, you know, it's not going to be that big of a deal. It's still going to be a little awkward, I feel like, because I know so many people that are going to be there.
Not, are you doing any jokes about working there? Like, do you have anything in your act that involves?
No.
That always makes it different, too, because one of the rules that that I've always used in the past is, I don't want to do jokes about the job I'm working at or the girl I'm dating currently. You know, like once we break up or I leave the job, all bets are off. Now it's changed a little bit because I got married this year and I'm not going to wait, you know, potentially until I die.
Right.
To tell jokes about my wife. But that was always a good rule to me because you just don't know what the sense of humor, and for me, I know some people, and this works for me. I'm not saying this is a steadfast rule that all comics should do because everyone's relationships are different. Everybody's personality is different. For me, it wasn't worth the potential fallback when I knew I could write other jokes. It's not like I was struggling to come up with bits.
Yeah.
So I never fall. And that's how I think of most things too. It's why I don't do a lot of political stuff on stage. I wasn't doing Donald Trump jokes because for me, the reward was not worth the risk.
Yeah, I'm, you know? Oh yeah, I'm right,
like,
there
it,
with you.
It worked. It's not that I think you can't joke about it. For me personally, I wasn't going to get as much back as I could potentially lose from trying to do it, so I didn't. That's how I feel about joking about your coworkers, your former coworkers potentially, depending on what the relationship is.
Yeah, and well, and I don't have any I haven't thought about that job since I quit. It was, you know, like it was like a corporate type job, like. It's whatever, but I just know that, you know, because the people that you know, I worked with or whatever are going to be there, it'll be awkward, but I'm not like super worried about it. I think I'm going to be fine because most of those people I haven't been in contact with since I quit. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, I don't know if they've kept up on my career, you know, because I worked there, this is like 11 years ago. I was just thinking about this the other day, talking to my partner, and I said, man, it's crazy because I actually, when I do this holiday party next month, 21 years ago, I started working at that company.
Oh, wow.
And then 10 years ago, I quit that company, or over 10 years, it'd be 11 years now, I quit that company. But I'm just like, wow, it's just crazy. But it'll be fun.
Well, the good thing is, too, for something like this is, sure, there's the potential it can be a little weird because you might recognize some people you know. Especially because, like, if this is a company party that they're hiring you for, it also opens up a lot of opportunities because you have some, you know, you have intricate knowledge, and maybe it's a little outdated because it's been, you know, 10, 11 years, but you also can be like, hey, is that water cooler still, you know, does it still blow up when you drink? You know, like you have things that you can talk about that, like you can do now those local references at a corporate party where if I got hired by that corporation, I would just be winging it.
Yep.
And maybe like, tell me five things about your boss that I can maybe roast him once.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
For like the bit. This, you actually were there. You're like, what was up with that creepy janitor who used to watch us when we peed? You know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You have some stuff. But you can also use it to your advantage to be like, oh, hey, I'm on you. I can say the stuff that I know pisses you all off that you can't say because you'll get in trouble.
Yeah.
I don't work there anymore. So I can kind of be like in your corner, like, oh, yeah, the boss is still sending out those stupid memos that don't make any sense. Yeah. You can do that stuff without being, you know, a dick about it and really get them on your side.
Oh, for sure. No, that's a very good point. And I probably will sit down and do some of that stuff. I actually already talked to somebody that I know still works there. And because I reached out, I was curious. I was like, who all still works there? You know, are there people that I know? And I was actually surprised. There was a lot of people that still work there from when I did. So they've worked there a long time. But yeah, it'll be fun. I'm going to make it fun. I'm excited because for me, I feel like it's full circle, you know, because I literally quit that job to move to California to pursue stand-up comedy. So comedy went full circle for me.
And the other thing that I always think of, and I know this isn't the most like romantic way to look at it, it's going to keep your bills paid too. So no matter, that's another reason that bombs or like whatever gigs don't bother me. Cause it's like, what do I want to do college gigs where they're going to make me talk at noon during finals week in the cafeteria? No, that's going to be an awful show. However, it's going to help me pay my mortgage.
Yep.
So I made the joke earlier, but not every joke's Carnegie Hall or not every show is Carnegie Hall, you know,
yep.
like AGT was the pinnacle of my career. 95% of my career was doing terrible dive bars for a bunch of drunk red fans, you know, like, you work hard and you go through all the bombing and all the nonsense and all the rough ones for those occasional, like, oh, I got, this is my special. This is amazing. I worked hard for this before you go back to that. So you kind of have to put it in that perspective too.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the way I always look at it. Like, even when if I have a bad show or, you know, if I do bomb or whatever, that's exactly, I'm like, well, I'm still getting paid. So
yeah,
it, you know,
yeah. I tell hecklers or people talking to me at shows or like if they're being weird, and I don't do it like in an aggressive way because if they don't want to laugh, they don't want to laugh. But like I'll do maybe like an act out and it doesn't get a laugh out. Like I'll keep doing this till I get paid. You know,
I'm just gonna go on repeat.
Yeah, I'll tell them like I'm not getting paid to be funny. I'm getting paid to talk for 60 minutes. I'll get rebooked if I'm funny, but that's not what I'm being paid for tonight. You know?
Oh,
funny,
man,
gets me work again, but tonight I'm not getting paid to make you laugh. I'm getting paid to talk for 60 minutes. So
yep, I have a time.
We can be on the same team or we can be against each other. You tell me.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I've got a contract of time that I have to fulfill. Other than that.
I can talk about whatever I want right now. It does not matter to me. So you guys can untighten your buttholes a little bit and we can have a good time. Or I can make this very awkward for you because I'm the only one leaving with more money than I came with.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I got a few things I like to talk about at the end of the show or towards the end of the show, some standard stuff. You know, the bumming of bombing is the dreadful feeling when you do bomb. How does that affect you and how has it changed over the years? I know you touched on it when you said that you have to leave what happens at the venue. So I'm curious how that's changed over the years.
It's one of those things like it's gotten it's both better and worse now, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because early on in my career, if I would have a bad set, you really don't know if you're good at that job for a long time. You don't actually know. Cause like sometimes you might have a 50-50 if you're lucky. Where it's like, sometimes I do well, sometimes I do horrible. So I don't actually know if I'm good at this or if I just had a good night that night, had a rough night that night. So early on when you bomb, like every time you bomb, it's hard in your head to be just like, not be like, I should quit. I'm not cut out for this. They didn't laugh. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. It's hard not to have that go through your head.
Oh, absolutely.
I've been doing this long enough now and I've crushed on like some of the highest levels you can possibly crush. So I know I'm good at this job, but the problem is when I do bomb, it hurts almost more because it doesn't happen as frequently. So I don't have it like you get thick skin if you bomb a lot or if you're not doing well for a while. You sort of get to like that's how you learn to overcome it and like not bomb as much. Because you're like, oh, it's not the end of the world. Next time, if I'm doing this, I can try this, and you figure it out. I'm not to be cocky. I do well most of the time because I know what I'm doing. I've just done this long enough.
Absolutely.
So when I do poorly, it's one of those things like it still rushes back to you really hard. Where you're like, I should probably just go back to school. This is not going to work out anymore. I'm done. And it's such a weird feeling because intellectually, you're like, no, I kill. I'm a killer. I'm a national headliner. I am really good at this. But it's still, you can't get that out of your brain where you're like, no, I suck now. That was this bomb. That means the last show was the last time I ever did well. It's nothing but bombs from now on.
Yeah, it's so easy to get that, like, once that's in your head, too, to, like, as comics, we don't, and I feel like this is a lot of comics. We don't give ourselves enough credit for the good shows. We only think about the bad ones, which is a benefit because what you learn from the bad ones, you don't necessarily learn from as much from the good ones. But it's easy to just be like, I suck forever now.
but you still have to learn from the good ones, too. Oh, like there's still something to be where you can be like, okay, why was that show so good? Mm-hmm. Oh, I added this tag, and that really helped that. Like you got to be able to look at the positives. I have friends that always think they bomb, like every set. They're like, I bombed. And I'm like, you got a standing ovation. What the hell? Yeah, but I flubbed this one line, and it didn't. This new joke I was excited about didn't work, so like I suck. Like, I feel as a comic, just to be able to survive this and not be miserable, you have to have good self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And that means, even if it's uncomfortable, acknowledging when you actually bombed, not pretending you crushed or did well. You have to be able to have enough, you know, self-awareness and believe in your heart enough that you'll be able to overcome it to go, okay, I really did suck tonight.
Yep.
And also, at the same time, be able to be like, hey, you know what? I actually crushed tonight. I was on fire. Everything hit the way I wanted to. I sold a ton of merch. They want me back. You have to be able to acknowledge that too, because you can also self-destruct if, because nobody wants to be around someone who's negative all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
So like, because it also can come off as like false modesty. If someone watches you crush and you're like, dude, that was amazing. You're like, no, it sucked. You're like, you're an asshole. You know you crushed. What are you doing? So, like, you can hurt yourself that way, too, which I think a lot of people don't understand. Because you always want to, like, you don't want to be cocky, but you need to be confident, too, and be like, no, I own that stage tonight. This was my night. Now, tomorrow might not be, but tonight, in this moment, I killed it. You got to be able to say that to yourself.
No, absolutely. I agree with that. Now, kind of to branch off onto that, or to tag onto that, talking about, you know, analyzing sets and learning from, you know, either the good or the bad, what are some things you try to look for to, you know, to continually improve on your jokes or your sets?
For me, it's always, I never want to declare a joke 100% done. If that makes sense, you know, I never want
to
say.
To me, 100. I'm very similar in that.
because just where you're at and where you are as an artist changes. So, for instance, I have bits that I do now that I maybe wrote the beginning parts of 8, 9, 10 years ago, but I wasn't a good enough comic to pull them off yet. And it's real easy to, like, you try something when you have the idea, it sucks. Because you're not good yet.
Yep.
You know, and then you just go, okay, well, that's gone forever. That's a stupid idea. I was dumb to even think about it. As opposed to just tabling it for a little bit. And then, oh, I have a bigger skill set now. I can pull this off now. And then bringing it back. And then not only that, once you get a joke to work, okay, I'm going to do this way for a while. Oh, is there something I can expand off it? Is there like a tag? Is there a different direction I can do now that makes that add? I've Frankenstein jokes together now that, like, okay, this half was part of this and this quarter was part of this and this. And they didn't work together as that because that joke was too wordy. But this line really helps this. And you got to be able to – that's how I analyze a lot.
Yeah, I'm very similar to that. Because I do that same thing. Like I always go back and look at my older material and say, you know, especially if something didn't work, and I think, well – I'm going to go back and look at it. Oh, maybe there is potential, especially now because I'm a better writer than I was, you know, 10 years ago or whatever it is. But I've also found the same thing where you might write a joke that does okay. You know, it's not terrible, but it's not great. And then you write another joke that's mediocre and it's part of another chunk. But then suddenly you realize if you put those two jokes together, it's a solid joke.
Yep. It's a real big thing. And for me, it's a lot of times it's like it's finding that good transition. I think transitions are overrated overall. I don't think everything has to be a clever segue to go like it's cool if you can do it. It's not necessary. I think a perfectly fine segue is just not talking for half a second.
Yep. Just taking a pause.
That's a segue. Like so many. That's a trap or like young comics fall into a lot where you think you have to have like a clever, pretty way to get into everything. And it's cool if you can do it. It's not necessary. It's an enhancement, not, you know, the meat of what you do. Sometimes, like, that's the thing, too, is, like, I'll be in the middle of telling a joke, and something I said goes, oh, that joke that never worked actually fits in right here. I'll give, like, kind of a current example for what I'm doing without getting too deep because it's too long of a joke. But so I have a joke about staying at a hotel in Alabama, and I woke up and I had ticks. It was the first time I ever had ticks. And at first it used to be just the story about how disgusting that was, you know, like I was by myself and you can't ask a stranger to take the tick out for you. You know, it's basically kind of like an ABC joke. You just get right there. The end of the joke was, I went to an urgent care. I had to spend $160, which is the first time I ever paid somebody to get something to stop sucking me. Like that's the joke. It's a veiled blowjob joke based on that. The original version of the joke is me 2.5-3 minutes. It's now a 15-minute bit because I kind of figured out halfway through. I used to have this bit. My older brother is a doctor of evolutionary biology who, like, does field work in nature. That's what he does. He's always out in nature doing stuff. And I had some jokes about it that didn't really fit anywhere before, so they never worked. And then when I went, ticks are in nature. I can do stuff about hating nature. I hate nature because my brother ruined nature. Here's what he does. Like now suddenly like, oh, those jokes work because they're a part of this structure. This umbrella structure now works like, oh, ticks are nature. He does nature. My brother's kind of a dick because he does this. I can do that and bring it. Like, so now this whole 15-minute story is so much more vibrant than either that 2.5-minute tick joke was or me rambling for 8 minutes about my brother being a nature guy who's kind of a dick sometimes. Together, it's like an Ultron situation. It's much stronger as a group than it is in individual parts because they just didn't make sense. There wasn't enough bulk to them to make it work.
Nope, that's absolutely brilliant to be able to do that. And I don't know the bit, but I'm going to have to go. I don't know if it's online, but I'm definitely intrigued because I was laughing right at the fact that you got ticks at a hotel because most of the time it's bed bugs, but the fact that you got ticks at a hotel.
Yeah. Initially the joke started about like how traveling can be like dangerous because I was starting to travel a lot and there's certain things like when you travel, you know, you might lose your luggage at the airport. That's something you can prepare for because you hear enough stories for that. You know, it's a possibility. You don't plan ahead for getting ticks at a Quality Inn.
Yeah.
You know, there's no battle plan. There's no reason you would ever prepare for that. But that's what happened. So now what are we doing with it? How are we dealing with it? It might be on the special. I recorded it for the special. We'll see how the actual.
Oh, I hope that turns out because I definitely want to see that. That's great. A couple more things that I like to talk about. When you have a joke that you tell and it bombs, like in the moment you do a joke, it just doesn't land for whatever the reason may be. What goes through your mind in that moment?
It depends on what type of joke it is. So if it's a joke that I'm telling for like the first or second time, like it's a really early running of the joke, that's panic sits in It's hard not to have at least a little bit of, and it's very fleeting. It goes away, and I can still finish my work. But you have this that where it's like, I was really proud of that. I thought that was going to do well. It sucked. Damn it. Like, oh, God, I'm horrible at that. You have that. Now, if it's a joke that I've told for years that I know works, I can easily write off as just like, either my delivery was just weird tonight, the energy of the crowd was weird, something had, like, I don't care in that case because I know I'll get them back. I was like, I know it's a good joke. It just, whatever reason, didn't work tonight. Because sometimes you just don't know ahead of time what the makeup of the audience is.
Yep.
You can, I'll give an example that happened with AGT. I had to cut a joke or I had to edit a joke. And so the time I told this joke on television was the first time I ever told it this way because I had to edit it that morning. So I did a set. It was during the semifinals about not knowing how to swim, and my friends get mad that I don't know how to swim because I won't go learn how to do it because I'm 40 years old. You don't need to learn to swim at 40. Who cares?
You just stay out of the water.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my point. I avoid water and I've won. It's not fun for me. So at this point, I'm past it. You don't need to do it. But my friends will trick me. They'll kind of come up with these like nightmare scenarios where swimming would be necessary to kind of try to trick me or convince me to do it. And like the example that I normally use during like the original way the joke was written, be like, okay, Ryan, what happens if you're on a boat and that boat starts to sink and there's no life jackets or lifeboats? What are you going to do then, Ryan? Well, I'm going to drown. I'm going to die in the water. And besides, if I was on a boat, clearly I was kidnapped because I wouldn't be there under my own power. So I'm glad that boat's sinking. I hope everybody dies. So that was the joke. Problem was so AGT's on a Tuesday. The Sunday before I was going to do that set, I don't know if you remember this at all. There was a fire on a boat off the coast of California, like near Catalina Island.
Yep.
That like 30 some people died because they got trapped in the fire. So I told that joke during dress rehearsals and the crew was like, oh, it was like this really like visceral, gross response. And normally the joke as I wrote it works fine. Because of outside circumstances, like of current events, I had to change it because what was going to happen, like, nationwide, I don't know if that joke would have offended anybody, but since that felt like AGT tapes in California, it was a very big local story. And if that audience reacts like poorly to what you say, people watching at home just think you bombed.
Yep.
You know, they don't know necessarily the context. They're just like, oh, that audience hated it, so we hate it too. So he's doing bad because they didn't laugh. They groaned at him. So I had to like think on the fly. I did something like, what happens if you're fishing and you fall off the boat? I'm like, why would I all be fishing? You could buy fish. I did some version of something like that, which I didn't think was as strong, but I had to pivot.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't go the other way. So sometimes you bomb based off what life has done.
Oh, absolutely. You
know, what the world has done.
Yeah. And it's, you know, sometimes it's good just to pay attention to outside things. I had that happen a couple weeks ago where I did a show on Friday, and then that Friday night there was a lot of storms, and down in the south all those tornadoes come through, and I have a joke about tornadoes. The next night in my next show, I did not do jokes about the tornadoes. I'm like, I've done this long enough to know that with everything that happened and has been on the news, if I do jokes about tornadoes, I'm going to look very, very bad. And they're probably not going to enjoy them right now.
Yep. And there's even an extent, too, of paying attention to what other people on the show have done as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like you can bomb just because you did a similar topic.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even like your joke was bad. Someone else just got to the topic first. It doesn't mean they stole it. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't even mean the jokes have to be that similar. But if you're talking about something specific, like, oh, he did a pro wrestling joke, now my pro wrestling joke's going to bomb because there's too many pro wrestling jokes or whatever it is. You know?
Yep.
So you got to be aware of that, too. There's a lot of reasons why you can bomb, and it's not just because you suck.
Yeah, no, you know? There's a lot of factors.
There's a lot of things. A
lot of factors. That's definitely one thing this show has brought out. There are a lot of factors in bombing.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, this has been great. I got a few more things at the end. I like to do more positive stuff. One of the things is we have Art of Bombing playlist of the Get Pumped. So it doesn't have to be a song that gets you pumped for comedy necessarily, just whatever it might be. Do you have a song that gets you pumped?
I will do it's hard to say one specific song, but I just mentioned pro wrestling. I'm a huge pro wrestling fan. I will do a lot of pro wrestling themes. Sometimes I'll just get like a playlist going on Spotify or something that's just all old WWE themes.
I love it.
And because they're designed to be like, you know, like Stone Cold Steve Austin's music still gets me going.
As soon as you hear that glass break, oh.
It takes me back to the time where I was like watching it and I was a part of that and being in there. Like, it's hard not to figure almost all of my AGT sets, like my persona, like coming out on stage, my entrances, it was just pro wrestling.
Yeah.
I was mimicking what I saw watching wrestling, you know? So like, I don't do my normal, if I'm in Des Moines, Iowa, I'm not like doing like, you know, flexes. No, I'm not doing that.
Not coming out there. You know? doing all
but
this
stuff.
But on
AGT, that's what I was coming out for. I was doing like the Hogan's, I was doing all that. And that's what I was listening to before. I would just fire up a couple of wrestling theme songs and then just go out there and go nuts.
Did you ever buy the compilation albums that they would put out of the theme songs?
And I did. 100%.
So did I.
Are you kidding me?
I'm actually wearing a WrestleMania shirt under my hoodie.
Nice.
You can't see it, but I have like, I think it's like from WrestleMania 4 or whatever. It's one of the classics. It's got like Ultimate Warrior and a bunch of other wrestlers on it.
Nice.
I'm a wrestling fan too, so
I love it. Yeah, I got to do the Jericho Cruise recently.
Oh man,
so I was one of the acts on that, and AEW, like they did wrestling match, so I got to hang out with a lot of the wrestlers and just feel like I was a part of it. It was, I'm glad they still paid me, but I would have done it for free just to get to hang out,
right?
And do all that. I had such a great time. And actually, I don't know. Do you follow AEW?
I haven't been keeping up on a lot of the more mainstream stuff. I like going to a lot of local indie stuff.
I've been doing
a lot of that.
Yeah, you have a lot of cool stuff up in Minneapolis.
Yeah,
too,
there's a lot of great productions up here.
Well, I was only mentioning it because my boy Ricky Starks, who is the FTW, part of Team Taz, he's the FTW champion in AEW, he came to my taping.
Oh, nice.
I met him on the cruise, and he actually came to the taping. So.
Shout
out
awesome.
To Ricky. I doubt he's listening to this because I'm sure he doesn't listen to anything else I say. But it was cool. He came out to that. So that's one of the coolest things, man. Like that's been one of the cool things about doing comedy. I wanted to be a wrestler. That's where Cripple Threat came from.
Yep.
That's where all that was a part of. And it just it wasn't going to work out. I'm not an athlete.
Yeah, me either. I did get to do when I lived in San Diego. So I have a friend that's a comic voice actor, and he does wrestling. He's always been in it or whatever. And he kind of started his own.
Who is it? I might know him.
John Allen is his name.
I know the name. I don't think I know John directly. But
yeah, he does a lot of – he does like – so he still wrestles, and he has this comical thing he does in L.A., the Ricardo Flair. It's like a big cheese thing.
Okay.
Like it's a funny spoof thing or whatever. But he used to kind of run his own wrestling production in San Diego, and I got to be a heel manager, and that was always fun. Like, I didn't, you know, I took a couple bumps or whatever, but I wasn't, like, officially trained, so I couldn't do a whole lot. But even being able to do that was so much fun.
Yeah, just getting to live vicariously and be around it, you know?
Yes.
For me, just, like, I got to watch the matches on the boat from, like, the crew area. So I was backstage, like, kind of with the wrestlers, getting to watch there. That was enough for me, just kind of getting to be a part of.
Yeah.
You know, get to feel like I was one of the boys for at least a weekend on the boat.
That's awesome. That sounds like so much fun.
Cool. Yeah, it was great. That was not a bomb. That was that was the opposite of the bomb. That's what the bombs led up to.
Is that what you just did all material about wrestling, right?
I did a little bit of it, but you just do your act and then just get into – yeah, you know, getting to roast Billy Gunn, for instance, was awesome. And
I met him at a convention at a comic book type convention that he was at, and oh my god, I got a picture with me and him, and his arms are about as big as my head.
Dude. Dude is 58. He's the most jacked human being I've ever seen. It's terrifying. So I'll do a little side note before we can finish up here and not go too long.
Yeah.
But so I became really good friends with Austin and Colton, who were his kids, mm-hmm. who wrestle for AEW now too. Great guys. So I become really good friends with them. On the cruise, every cruise ship does like a celebrity family feud if it's this type of cruise at some point. So I was part of the Jericho Cruise family feud situation. And I was good for – I got to know Austin and Colton on the boat, and I helped with, like, a comedy show a little bit that Billy Gunn was a part of. And we kind of talked a little bit, but not a ton.
Yeah.
We were friendly. So I'm on the same Family Feud team as Billy is, and we're about to get called on stage. He's right behind me. Right before we went on stage, I just turned and looked at him, just looked right in his eyes and went, "Don't you fuck this up for me, Billy." I don't know what made me want to do that, but it just felt right in that moment. And thank God he laughed. Like, that was one of the best laughs I got that entire trip, because he could have killed me.
Right.
But just, like, for me, it's so cool because, like, all this hard work, like 15-year-old me can't imagine that he would be, like, hanging out with Billy Gunn and then making Billy Gunn laugh, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
By basically just telling him, not by basically, like, roasting him or insulting him. So, like, my life is very cool now.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
39-year-old me is like, I got a really cool life. I know these interesting people. 16-year-old me is constantly losing his shit.
Can't even hold the composure,
oh,
that's for sure.
It's wild, man.
It's funny, you know, that you brought up Billy Gunn, because in San Diego, I used to run a show, and we had Adam Hunter headline this weekend.
I know Adam.
And Chuck, is it? I'm going to butcher. I always get his last name wrong, but is it like Chuck Palenko?
Palumbo.
There we go. I always get it wrong. I always want to say Palenko, but yeah, Palumbo. He actually came to a show, so I got to meet him too. So I met both him and Billy Gunn, which I thought was kind of
nice.
Different times, like years apart, but it was still kind of a cool thing.
That is cool. You got the whole tag team champion combination there.
Yeah, over time. It's pretty awesome. All right, well... And maybe we already talked about it, because you talked about doing this cruise and then being on AGT, but I like to have a positive thing at the end where I like to know what your favorite or one of your best gigs was so far in comedy.
I mean, it's I know it's probably like the obvious answer. It's hard to beat AGT.
Yeah, for sure.
Through that whole setup, I got, you know, 5 standing ovations through the entire thing. Like, I got 3rd place overall, like. It's hard to beat that, especially because those are the largest in-person crowds too. Not even just factoring in the TV crowds, mm-hmm. you know, the audition's done at the Pasadena Civic Center, which is like 4,000 people.
Wow.
Then you know, it was like 400 or 500 because they do Universal Studios for the judge cuts, so you're like on a soundstage, and then the Dolby Theater is like 3,000. So like those were the largest like in-person crowds I'd ever been in front of too, and so. So it's hard to say. And AGT also helped me rekindle with my wife. Like we weren't married until like we had dated years ago, and we sort of reconnected.
And
I invited her. Like we had talked on and off for years.
Yeah.
But she was kind of my one that got away. And when I found out I was doing AGT, I took a chance and invited her to come to the audition. And thank God I didn't bomb there. That would have been a rough move. It's like, in hindsight, I'm kind of like, you're an idiot. You didn't know that was going to go well. I hadn't like actually seen her in years, like physically seen her in years. So it's like the first time we kind of like re-hang out again, I bomb in front of millions of people. That would have probably not been the best
that would have like
way to put my foot back forward.
Changed again. The whole directory of the rest of your life.
Exactly. So.
And not for the positive.
So thank you, AGT fans, for helping me get married. I appreciate it.
That's beautiful. Well, the last thing I like to do, we play a fun game called Pick a Number. You're going to pick a number between 1 and 20. I'm going to ask you a corresponding question that may or may not be related to comedy.
Got it. Number 8.
Number 8. What's the most useless talent you have?
The most useless talent that I have. Cool. I'm pretty useless outside of comedy, so it's hard to pick. Just
I feel you.
I don't know if it's a talent per se, but it kind of goes piggybacks off what we were just talking about a little bit ago. I have such a encyclopedic knowledge of pro wrestling and video game stuff that outside of a few nerds means nothing to anybody whatsoever. Like I'm talking, I've forgotten how to do math because I had to memorize 1950s pro wrestling. Like, that's kind of what my brain does.
Yeah.
And it's always hard to say because, like, this is like, I don't want to get too deep on you here, but I never think anything that brings you joy is useless per se.
No, absolutely. I totally agree.
That's always one of the things. Like, I will occasionally bust my friend's balls if they like something I don't like, but if I ask you what you're into or like what's your hobby, what's your thing you're into, and you can't answer me right away, I do not trust you as a human being because you are a scary human. You need to have at least one thing in your life, no matter how big or small it is. I go a little nuts, as you can tell by the wrestling or the video game collection there. I might go a little overboard with the things that I like. But if you don't have at least one thing in your life that you have for no other reason other than it makes you happy, you are a scary, incomplete person. Like, those people become, like, you know, mass shooters, I think.
Yeah, probably not wrong.
You got to have stuff that doesn't necessarily make you money. It doesn't necessarily, you know, enhance your career. It's not like career build. It's just something that you do because it makes you smile.
Yep.
So
that's beautiful.
If you don't have that, please find it. Life is way too short to worry about fucking career building retreats and workshops all the time
and worrying about what other people will think if they find out you enjoy a thing. Who cares?
If you want to be a 40-year-old man and love the Twilight movies still, go nuts. Have fun, because it doesn't matter.
That's exactly right. That's a beautiful way to close out this show. Thank you so much for doing this, taking the time to be on the podcast. Where would you like to direct people to follow you or find you online?
Cripplethreat.com has my calendar if you want to see like live shows. I also post those on all my regular social medias, so Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Xbox Live if you want to game with me. It's all Cripplethreat8. That's the number 8, in case you are curious. There were 7 before me, but I've risen to power. So find me on there. Same thing. My Alexa is now responding to Cripplethreat8 right now, by the way. So,
oh, that's hilarious.
In case you heard that.
I didn't, but that's great. All right.
Awesome. So find me on there. Say hello. Come to a show. I love you all. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
This has been brought to you by Dead and Mellow. Follow us on all your social media platforms and shop around at deadandmellow.com to see all of our stand-up, music, and podcast releases. Thank you, and God bless America.
All right, see you later.
See you.
Are we actually leaving or just it?
The Art of Bombing is a Blitzed Entertainment production, hosted and produced by me, Dan Bublitz Jr. The stand-up spotlight bumper was produced by Joe Nicola Music. The Art of Bombing theme music was written and performed by John Holt. All other music was used under Creative Commons licensing. All stand-up audio clips were used with permission from the comedians. You can help the podcast by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating, and a review. For previous episodes, merch, blogs, and more, please visit theartofbombingpod.com. And remember, stay safe so you can live to love.